Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Let's get into the early life of Hubert Gerald Jr. Hit it, Beth!
Hubert Gerald Jr. was born on November 13th, 1964. He grew up on Staten Island. We don't know much about his early life. All we could find was that his father abandoned the family when Hubert was very little, and he was abused by his stepfather's mother's boyfriend. I'm not sure if she was actually married to him.
Okay. Hubert dropped out of public school for students with learning disabilities when he was 14 years old. At the age of 16, he was arrested as part of a purse-snatching ring. In 1990, he was convicted of robbery and served 2 years in prison in New York.
So he didn't have much of an education.
No.
He dropped out of school when he was 14.
Yeah.
So he didn't have a lot of opportunities.
You're right. Yes.
After being paroled in June of 1992 when he was 27, Gerald moved to Chicago and lived with family. In January of 1993, he was charged with residential burglary. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He was then paroled on October 29th, 1994, and moved in with his brother.
1994 is the year that Joe Biden drafted the 1994 crime bill.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
It
seems like yesterday, and it was a long time ago.
I know. Well, I agree. It does seem like yesterday because I do remember it being hearing grownups talking in the 90s when I was a kid about, wow, these people aren't really serving that much time. Oh, thank goodness for this crime bill.
Yeah.
And then you get to three strikes, you're out, and it's off to the races.
Wow.
Now we have an uncontrollable population of incarcerated people. Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah.
But Hubert was described by some neighbors as, quote, strange and kind of slow, unquote. We don't say that anymore, but that's what people used to say.
That's what people used to say.
Yeah. So he had a reputation for being streetwise and docile when sober, but unpredictable and violent when not. His IQ had been tested as low as 59, but IQ tests are racist bullshit. Anyway.
Yeah. He was a handyman who liked to tinker in the basement of his brother's home, and he held short-lived jobs at local grocery stores. He often hung out at the laundromat and would offer to carry groceries home for women.
Sounds benign enough. No?
Yeah, it does sound benign, right?
Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah, I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering?
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp.com/fruit.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
So let's get into the timeline. What do you got for us, Beth?
From September 1993 to June 1999, Chicago police accumulated a large number of unsolved murders in Englewood, and all of them were similar to each other. The victims were poor Black women. Most of them were sex workers. The bodies were found in warehouses and uninhabited buildings, deserted streets and dumpsters. Almost all of them had been raped.
Sergeant Jack Ridges, a Chicago homicide investigator, kept a database with information on 66 women who had died in Chicago since 1989. What linked the women was not necessarily the manner of their deaths, but the fact that they were sex workers with substance abuse issues.
Ridges began collecting information on the murders in 1992 when he was assigned to assist Los Angeles police investigating the murder of a sex worker by a sailor who had lived in Englewood. Los Angeles police wanted to know whether a connection might exist between the sailor and any unsolved homicides in Chicago.
Ridges never found a link that would help the Los Angeles police, but along the way, he came to the realization that there were a lot of unsolved murders that fit a pattern. Six detectives were assigned exclusively to work with Ridges on the murders.
What police did not know is that there were at least two serial killers working in Englewood between 1993 and 1999. One of them was Andre Crawford, who we covered back on episode 204, and another was Hubert Gerald's.
So Gerald's MO was to offer drugs to a woman, get her into a secluded place, choke her into unconsciousness, and then rape her. If afterwards the woman was still alive, he strangled or suffocated her to death.
On December 21st, 1994, the partially skeletonized body of 18-year-old Rhonda King was found on the third floor of a boarded-up building. Rhonda's body was unclothed, except for a coat and cushion covering her head.
The body was in a bad state of decomposition, and the medical examiner could find no obvious signs of trauma. However, a bloodstain had been found about 2 feet from Rhonda's head, and there appeared to be bloodstains on her clothing.
Although her cause of death was listed as undetermined, police suspected foul play, but absent any evidence, the case went cold.
On December 22, 1994, the body of 37-year-old Dorothea Withers was found. Dorothea was quiet and kept to herself. She had a day job, but according to neighbors, she worked as a sex worker in the evenings. She'd been burglarized, and afterwards, she moved out of the apartment that she lived in, but the neighbors did not know where she'd gone.
On March 14, 1995, Alonda Tart, 23, was found dead. She had been strangled to death and her body left in an abandoned building.
Alonda left home at the tender age of 14, so a baby when she left.
Yeah.
And ended up on the streets and fell into a heroin addiction. The men that she hung out with often turned violent, and she'd at times been beaten and threatened to death. So when her body was found on West 54th Street, she was chalked up as just another victim of the streets.
On March 26, 1995, Gerald's reported finding the body of Joyce Wilson, 28. So Hubert Gerald himself reported.
Oh, what a good Samaritan.
Yeah. Joyce Wilson's body was found in a broken down truck a few blocks from Gerald's house. Joyce was the mother of four children, but she could not beat her addiction. Her mother and eight brothers and sisters warned her that she might turn up dead one day, and they begged her to get clean. They obviously loved her.
Yeah.
But she just couldn't do it.
Addiction is hard.
Yeah.
It is so fucking hard. So if she couldn't beat it, it's not because she wasn't strong enough or she didn't have enough willpower or any bullshit like that. It's just really hard.
It just had her too hard. Yeah.
Gerald's was questioned by police, but was not a suspect at the time. He later bragged to a neighbor that he was the killer, but would never be caught because he was careful not to leave behind any evidence.
Sure, Gerald.
Okay. The neighbor didn't believe him.
On April 14th, 1995, Kleshawn Hopes, 25, spent the evening smoking crack with Gerald's. Afterwards, she and Gerald's left her apartment on South Elizabeth Street in search of more drugs.
They split up, she said, because she wanted to buy drugs with cash and he wanted to buy crack on credit. Bad business decision, bro. While Kleshawn was walking by an alley, she was grabbed from behind. Quote, I was being lifted off the ground and started to black out, unquote. It's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. She awakened in a van with Gerald's raping her. He had his hand on her throat and was startled to see that she'd woken up. Kleshawn managed to escape by diving headfirst into a piece of plywood taped over the doorframe of the van.
Wow.
Pushing the board free and falling to the ground.
Golly, she's like an action movie star.
Yeah, no
shit. Oh my gosh, way to go. So naked from the waist down, Hopes said she ran like hell to her home where police were called. She initially told several different and false versions of what had happened, and we can understand why. About that, she later said, quote, getting high was an immoral thing in my family, and I tried to hide it. I almost lost my life, and I was in jeopardy of losing my kids and everything around me, unquote.
Yeah.
I don't even need a culture corner. She explained why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On June 7th, 1995, the partially clad body of Lovey Ford, 26, was found in some bushes near an elementary school. She had been strangled to death and was found by some seventh graders playing baseball nearby.
Sad for everybody involved.
Traumatizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In June of 1995, Millicent Jones, 25, known as Peanuts by her friends and family, disappeared. It wasn't unusual for Millicent, who had a history of drug use, to disappear for hours or days at a time to feed her habit.
Millicent's mother described her as a sweet girl who never forgot a birthday, a holiday, or anything that pertained to her sons. So when she missed her son's first grade graduation, her mother and sisters knew that something was wrong.
Hmm.
And on June 12, 1995, Millicent was found dead.
I admire people who have that intuitive gift to just know. You know, they
know
just knew something is wrong. Yeah.
I think something's wrong all the time.
You do?
My daughter and I, when we call each other, because we're the same way, so I'll call her, and the first thing I'll say is, everything's fine.
Oh. When my mom calls me, I'm like, who died?
I expect
the worst, but I want to be better at trusting my intuition, like Millicent's family.
Yeah.
So Mary Blackman, 42, was friends with Hubert Gerald's sister, Angela. Mary's children had all moved to Kansas, and they were trying to get her to move there too, but she wanted to stay in Chicago. And my understanding is that she was staying at the Gerald's house.
Yeah, so she's living at the house where Hubert Gerald's lives. On June 17th, 1995, Angela, investigating the source of a foul odor, found Mary's body in a trash bin behind the Gerald's neighbor's house.
Oh my God.
And she contacted authorities.
To police, Angela described her brother Hubert as a drug addict who occasionally became violent when doing drugs.
Doing drugs!
Yeah, doing drugs! We haven't said that in a long time. So just a few days earlier, he had come into her bedroom. She said he was high on drugs, looking crazy, and foaming at the mouth.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm.
That would be terrifying.
Yes,
you know,
indeed.
That's one of the reasons why I lock my bedroom door.
You lock your bedroom door?
Yeah. It's a habit because I was always afraid my brother was going to come into my room.
Oh, Beth. And you still do it to this day?
Yep.
Wow. I think whatever you got to do. I mean, I lock all the doors behind me, but I don't necessarily lock the doors inside my house, but definitely the outside ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hashtag be like Beth. I say it all the time.
Yeah, just because he also did drugs.
did drugs. Oh, man.
So Gerald shook his sister and demanded money. But she was able to fend him off with a razor blade.
Wow.
Wow. Angela told police she believed that her brother might have been involved in the death of her friend, Mary Blackman.
All right, let's get into the investigation and the arrest. So one of the detectives on Sergeant Ridge's task force recognized Gerald's name as the person who in March had reported the murder of Joyce Wilson, who was 20 years old. And Joyce's body was found in an abandoned truck.
Then Kleshawn Hopes identified Gerald as the assailant who had raped her on April 14th, 1995, and from whom she narrowly escaped.
On June 19th, 1995, police interviewed Hubert Gerald, and under interrogation by police, Gerald confessed. According to Gerald's confession, he didn't plan the attacks, but killed the women in fits of anger.
So to me, it sounds like he wanted to have sex with them and killing them was like
in his mind the only way,
an afterthought. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So,
like,
say that again.
I don't know that killing them was what got him off.
Oh, because of all the articles you've read about this case that imply.
I guess we'll get into it later. Yeah. Sorry.
That's
I jumped
okay.
the gun.
That's okay.
So he was shown a photograph of Rhonda King, and Gerald said Rhonda was one of the women that he strangled and killed, and he provided a written statement to that effect. But also, during the interrogation, he said, quote, "Wait a minute, I didn't kill all these women. There's other people out there killing women," unquote.
Wait. And doesn't it make you wonder, wait, like, is there a club? A club?
Yeah.
People like, how do you know
club.
That? Like,
well, he knows that if he knows that there's 10 women who are dead and he only killed 6 of them, then obviously somebody else is killing the other 4.
But is it a friend of yours? Friend of yours, Gerald?
It could be, yeah.
So at the same time, a man named Derek Fluellen was arrested and charged with the murder of Lovey Ford and another woman named Sherry Hunt, who was 35 when she died. So now let's get into the trial. What the what, Beth?
Gerald's defense lawyer said he was mentally challenged, had a mental age of 8, and was a child in a man's body. They argued that Gerald, who nodded off through much of the 2-week trial, had also suffered a childhood of savage abuse at the hands of his mother's boyfriend.
But Dr. Albert Stipes, a psychiatrist for the prosecution, testified that Gerald was a malingerer who faked mental illness and, quote, played dumb, unquote, to avoid punishment. And I will also say that sometimes mental health and medical practitioners just refuse to see the symptoms that a Black person or a brown person might be exhibiting.
Right.
Studies show,
call them malingerers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, doctors think that Black people have more nerve endings and have higher thresholds of pain, all kinds of bullshit like that. So Dr. Stipes, appreciate your opinion, but yeah. So anyway, I'm not sympathizing. Like, I don't have sympathy for Gerald for being a murderer, but he clearly had
issues.
Deficits. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't see how somebody could see that as faking it. But prosecutors described Gerald as, quote, an ugly, violent force, unquote.
They said that when he killed the women, he used a technique that he called the guardian angel chokehold, which he had learned in a self-defense class in his native New York.
I was wondering what he was doing in a self-defense class. Like, you know, maybe trying to learn how to accost people or better attack people. I was just really curious by this fact, this little fact in the story.
I mean, anybody could use a self-defense class, I guess, you know?
I guess.
I mean, if you're attacking people, you have to defend yourself as well.
I guess he just seems like an unlikely client.
Candidate for that kind of thing.
Yeah, candidate for that kind of class.
Who knows? Maybe somebody signed him up for it. Or who knows? Or maybe when he was a kid.
Maybe. Okay.
Yeah.
So Clashawn Hopes testified during the trial. In other testimony, Jacqueline Kelly, a former South Side resident who had moved to Minnesota, testified that in March or April of 1995, she heard Gerald's claim responsibility for several murders of women in the neighborhood. But at the time, she believed he was kidding.
Jacqueline said, quote, "He said he was just too smart for the police. He said they had no evidence. He said he made it look like a rape, and then police would think it was just a rapist, not a serial killer," unquote. Which is pretty dumb.
I've done it. But you just confessed, and your words are also evidence, so...
Also, they're dead, so that's kind of what serial killers do.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but the math ain't mathin', Gerald! So she also said that Gerald's told them that he had been questioned by police, but released. And he showed them the release papers. "Look at me! I've got a release ticket!"
After the three-week trial and 12 hours of deliberation, on November 13, 1997, the day of his 33rd birthday, Gerald's was convicted of first-degree murder. He also was convicted of sexually assaulting one victim and of the attempted murder of Clashawn Hopes.
The jury found nothing in mitigation to preclude imposition of the death penalty. And on January 9, 1998, he was sentenced to death.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
So now let's get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Gerald's is currently incarcerated at the Menard Correctional Center in Chester, Illinois. He is serving a life sentence and is ineligible for parole.
In December of 1998, Chicago police, with the assistance of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, began comparing DNA recovered from murder victims in Englewood. The seminal DNA recovered in many of these cases was the same.
In 1999, Derek Fluellen was acquitted of the murder of Lovey Ford. DNA tests of semen taken from Lovey Ford matched that of Hubert Gerald's. Sherry Hunt, the other woman he was charged with murdering, had been found dead in her apartment, and there was no evidence that she was even murdered.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. I love DNA. DNA does it again. You know what? I gotta do something over here. Excuse me. Thanks, DNA. So Flewellen said that he was tortured and coerced by police officers to give false confessions. Remember what I was telling you about earlier?
Yep.
And he had an injured foot at the time of his interrogation and alleged that an officer stomped on his injured foot and proceeded to crush the wheels of a metal chair into his wounds.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
He said that seven detectives beat him over the course of 36 hours, ignoring his pleas for a lawyer, sleep, and pain medication, while threatening that CPS would take his girlfriend's infant son away from her. Following this barrage, he quote-unquote confessed.
Mm. Unable to afford bond, Flewellen spent 4.5 years in Cook County Jail. So jail is detention. That's where they keep you before you're even, like, convicted. It's just to hold you there until your trial. So 4 years when you're supposed to have a speedy trial is incredibly fucked up.
Yeah.
So Cook County Jail, before a judge, found him not guilty. And even after, each of the officers who interrogated Flewellen testified against him.
Mm. 6 months after he was set free, Flewellen filed a civil complaint against the detectives. Although the officers denied his accusations, the city of Chicago eventually settled Flewellen's claims of false arrest and malicious prosecution for $250,000 in 2002.
Mm-hmm. Not enough, no. But there
at
you
go. At least
it's
something.
Yeah. In January of 2000, Andre Crawford, who we covered in episode 204, confessed to Rhonda King's murder. And his version of events matched the crime scene, whereas Gerald's version of events did not. And subsequent DNA testing identified Crawford's DNA and excluded Gerald's in that murder.
On February 10th, 2000, prosecutors moved to vacate Gerald's conviction for Rhonda King's murder. Prosecutors also vacated the other five convictions. Gerald's then pleaded guilty to the other five murders and was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
A 5-month investigation revealed that five of the officers accused of using torture to coerce 11 false confessions remained on the force. Three had actually been promoted.
Ugh.
More money and more power is what they earned for this fuck up. Wow.
Fuckery. Yeah.
So now we're going to get into our takes and what we think made Gerald's snap.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Beth?
Well, a lot of the articles that I read mentioned that Gerald's had a paraphilia, which is defined as a condition characterized by abnormal sexual desires, typically involving extreme or dangerous activities.
Mm.
Specifically, in Gerald's case, he wanted to have sex with women while they were sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And just to be clear, fetishes are, quote, non-traditional sexual interests or behaviors or kinks that are, for a particular individual, a deep and abiding and possibly even necessary element of sexual arousal and activity, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Paraphilias are fetishes that have escalated in ways that have resulted in negative life consequences.
Uh-huh.
So they're different.
They're different. One is harmful.
Yes, exactly.
And the other one cannot be.
Yeah.
And not here to kink shame. Just got to say that.
No, that's why I wanted to make that claim.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. It is also alleged that he was beaten by his stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there was anger.
Yeah.
He was allegedly mentally challenged and he probably had no idea what to do with his feelings.
Yeah.
And probably had no help trying to figure them out as a boy and a young man.
Yeah. Now that you say that, the fact that he may have been beaten by his stepfather, coupled with the abandonment by his biological father.
Biological father,
I'm sure played a role in his development, his social and emotional learning and resiliency. And the idea that he had this compulsion to have intercourse with bodies that were asleep.
Not moving.
Or not moving. Kind of, to me, seems like he was afraid of, like, being hurt or abandoned.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, what's his face? Oh, my God. I can't remember the name of the murderer.
Are you going to name one of the whites? The famous whites?
Yeah, one of the whites. Famous white murderer.
Which one?
Why can't I remember?
Which one? There's so many. I mean, I can't. Shit. I can't Why think. Can't I've actually Dahmer.
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes.
Jeffrey Dahmer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he also did not want to have to talk to people.
Yeah, it was hard, you know, for them because of how they grew up and not having, again, social and emotional like fortitude.
Right. And Jeffrey Dahmer's solution was to try to make zombies. Whereas this guy,
can you rule it out as a suggestion? I'm totally kidding. That was a bad joke. I'm like sweating, like thinking of people hating my guts after I said that.
So Jeffrey Dahmer's solution was to create zombies, mm-hmm. and this guy's solution was to choke them until they pass out. Mm-hmm. And I think, like I said before, that I think killing them was an afterthought.
Yeah, like an unintended consequence.
An unintended consequence, or possibly done so that they couldn't talk.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that he confessed to a murder that he did not commit was at first weird to me, but then in the face of this being Chicago, Commander Berg, Chicago, and his police regime, it's no surprise.
Yeah.
It's no surprise that somebody who was completely innocent got caught up in this case too. I feel really bad for that guy who spent 4 years in jail and couldn't get out just because he didn't have the money for bail. Now, this is Chicago. I personally find it hard to trust the word of any public official in Chicago, police, mayors, prosecutors, Rob Blagojevich, LOL. and I feel really badly for the women who were victims of Gerald's. But they were also victims of society and circumstances, like not being born into the dominant caste or class, aka white and wealthy. You know, poverty was a factor. Lack of resources and support was a factor, not just for their mental health, because a lot of them seem to be suffering from addiction issues and engaged in the survival industry, but who helped, you know, who was there to help a young Rhonda or a young Dorothea or a young Alonda or a young Joyce or a young Millicent or Marie or Lovey when they needed employment or a coat on a cold day? Chicago gets cold as fuck. Or a meal or healthcare. Like, if they had access to those things, I don't even know if this would be a case we would be talking about.
Yeah.
And people don't just become addicted to drugs for no reason.
Yeah.
Or turn to survival work for no reason.
Yeah.
And I gotta say this, it's election season and every politician is like, I'm gonna be so tough. I'm gonna be the toughest on this and tough on that. I'm gonna crush that problem's balls. And it's like, can we just, like, how about some humanity? What if we try something different? Maybe this toughness thing isn't working.
Yeah,
the 94 crime bill, was like 40 years ago and or 30 years ago. And are we any better from this ramping up of toughness? People need like care, humanity, respect, grace, all these things. So anyway, all these numerous systems failed, I think, everybody in the story along the way.
Yeah, agreed.
I've already talked about it all. But I hate to say this, but I have a young son. And we are hard on my son only because, you know, if a police officer asks him a question and he doesn't answer right away, he does his little, gosh, mom, or ignores the police officer, he could be dead. You know, he could end up
it's
in jail.
Scary.
And it's terrifying. And so I feel really, really bad for the young Black boy that Gerald was. He wasn't even safe in his own home. And he became a young person and eventually an adult who harmed other vulnerable people in his community. And, you know, they basically had him doing the cha-cha slide from one incarceration to the next. And he never got what he needed either.
Yeah.
Rehabilitation. I mean, if you're going to put somebody away, are we going to do anything to make them better? I don't know.
Exactly. That's what I always think of. Like, okay, you want these people to be punished, but they're going to come out eventually.
Exactly.
Do you want them to come out worse?
Mm-hmm.
Do
we want to put our citizens into a place that's going to make them worse and then release them and have them be more damaged and inflict more harm on our communities? You know what I mean? It doesn't, the math ain't mathing, and we have to do something different. And This is no secret. I'm a prison abolitionist and a police abolitionist. But yeah, get out of here. And I know that there's a lot of love for the city of Chicago. But I also think there is a lot not to love. You know, Chicago is no stranger to corruption, under-resourcing of its marginalized communities, and also ignoring and minimizing the value and contributions that those marginalized communities are doing within their own communities to protect and support and uplift themselves. So this case had all the themes to talk about. I am dying to know what you fruities think, and you know where to find us.
Yeah, get at us. Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media.
This is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine. From history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and...
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts. And on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
Ohio is a land of mystery. From missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface, to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people, to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app, and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.